Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week, our writer Jimmy Israel, with us from Cleveland. In New York, Pablo Torre, senior writer with ESPN. Corey Dade is a contributing editor to The Root. That's an online publication that focuses on issues of particular interest to African Americans. He's here with me in our Washington, D.C. studios, and with us from Austin, where he writes for the National Review magazine and works for the Texas Public Policy Foundation, Mario Loyola. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas, welcome to the shop. How are we doing?
What's up?
Last what up? Friday.
What up, though?
It feels like a family reunion. So many people like we haven't had in the shop in a
while. So glad to see you all.
P-Dog.
Here
you
are. Glad to be back.
Well, check this out. It's kind of a, we kind of got to get a rough start because we're talking about two tragic situations this week that didn't seem to offer a lot of good options. Right, Michelle?
Yeah, that is true, Jimmy. So let's start with what happened in the Capitol yesterday. A 34-year-old woman who's now been identified as Miriam Carey reportedly tried to ram a barrier with her car near the White House. She took off. The police gave chase, which ended near the Capitol, where she was shot and killed. She had her one-year-old child in the car with her, who is okay. And information about Carey is still coming out. Her mother told reporters that she'd been suffering from postpartum depression, and her employer, she was a dental hygienist, had said that her behavior had become very erratic in recent months, and they were very worried about her. So that's
yes.
What happened. Yeah.
Thank you for that, Michelle. Yeah. You know, people are giving props to the Capitol Police for acting swiftly. And that's positive, you know, because there's really no time to be tactical in a kind of situation where you believe the president or other people may be in danger. So you have to, you can't, there's no morning, Monday morning quarterbacking for that kind of thing, you know. So, but some people are questioning if Carey's death could have been avoided and whether police were too quick to shoot. Me, you know, Corey Dade, I say no, they weren't. But you're in D.C., so tell me what's the word.
Yeah, I'm here in D.C., and no one is second-guessing that. I mean, at this point, we are 3 weeks removed from the Navy Yard shooting. You know, for the rest of America, they need to understand, here in D.C., these things are affecting people's everyday lives. We live this stuff beyond the shenanigans that happen in Congress and in the White House. We live this every day. So, you know, I have family and friends who worked either in the Navy Yard or next door in the Department of Transportation. I have friends who work right there in the Capitol. So they are directly affected by this. And no one's questioning whether or not she should have been shot or not. You know, it's just a horrible tragedy. And now they're finding, back in her apartment in Connecticut, they're finding antipsychotic and antidepressant drugs that she apparently was taking. So this is just a horrible tragedy all the way around.
Mario.
Yeah, I rarely question, you know, police acting according to procedure, but I wonder if these procedures are a little bit too, you know, precautionary. I mean, Americans have gotten into a habit of imposing lots of precautionary measures no matter how much they cost, and I just think, I wonder if cooler heads could have prevailed and one of the cops could have said, look, this looks like a woman having a nervous breakdown. On the other hand, you know, it's hard to second guess it. A car is a deadly weapon and she was using it like one. So
I think he raises an important point mm-hmm. because when you're in an environment where people sort of, where security is kind of the first thing that people think of, that's kind of the default is that, I mean, look, in the spirit of full disclosure, you all know I have come from a police family. I have six police officers in my family. Mm. And, you know, I always think, what would it be if they were in that situation? They could see that there was they say they didn't know there was a baby in the car. She was in the car seat. But they knew eventually that there was one. And you can imagine what those officers are feeling now.
Yep.
Michelle, I take your point because my very best friend in the world is a police officer. Uh-huh. So I take your point. But I'm mostly concerned about him and also a civilian who's whipping around a 3-ton car at 40-30 miles an hour. I don't know what the options are exactly, and there's no time to do a Dr. Phil intervention. Like, I wonder what's on her mind. No.
Let's think about that. I mean, that in part there's a difference between the Army and the police. I mean, the police are civilians who are sworn to protect us. The Army is different. Their job is to inflict maximum damage on the enemy. There's a difference. So
and then there's the Secret Service who was on hand, who had to protect the president.
I think our car, go ahead, Pablo.
No, I was just going to say, driving a car into a White House checkpoint at any time, let alone after the Navy Yard shootings, I think it's one of those things where you unfortunately cannot be surprised at the outcome. The optics, to use a political term, as Mario referred to, are bad. I mean, insofar as there could ever be a scale of good and bad here, it being a mother with a child, certainly, that, I think, is the factor that makes us sort of even consider second-guessing this. But at the same time, I mean, to me, I think the big takeaway here is the mental illness angle. It's the idea that if this woman had erratic behavior at work and at home, and I'm not blaming anybody who knows her, obviously, but certainly I think mental health awareness is never something that you can beat the drum too much for.
Amen, it's interesting, brother. We were just talking about this in connection with the Navy Yard shooting. We were just talking about this, like, what can you do if someone you're connected to, an adult particularly, is showing signs of erratic behavior and seems showing signs of mental illness? What can you do?
Erring on the side of a conversation is always, in my opinion, preferable to saying nothing.
Well, then let's talk about that other situation that also poses dilemmas, I think, for many people. Many people don't know how they would feel about that. And, Jimmy, that was that situation in New York between the motorcycles and the driver of the Range Rover. By now, most people have seen the video, thanks to a helmet camera. But the incident is still under investigation, because the question still becomes what happened before and after the exchange. And what you know, if you've seen it, is that the driver of the Range Rover, a man named Alexian Lean, bumped into a biker on a New York highway. Lean stops within biker, circled his SUV, so he takes off. A couple of bikers were hit, and then other bikers chased after him, stopping the SUV again, and they drag him out of the car and beat him.
It's really, really unfortunate, because there are a lot of reports. CNN is reporting that the bikers had just kind of stopped because there was an accident, Lean looked like he was leaving the scene of an accident, and it just, this whole thing kind of spiraled out of control. His wife and 2-year-old child were in the car. And his wife said he drove away from the bikers the first time because they feared for their lives. You know, but here's what Miss Diana Mises, the wife of the biker who was hit, this is what she said about the situation. Drop that tape.
When you look at the video, you can see he's running over something. It's not just a motorcycle. It's a human being that was under there. Whatever he did, he got scared. He went paled off, and he paralyzed my husband on the way.
Wow. Thank you for that. You know, so Mises, she wants Lean charged, claiming the bikers are the victims. And, you know, when I saw this tape, I was reminded, and this is all jokes aside, I was reminded of the scene from Color Purple where Miss Millie is having trouble with the car, and out of fear of all the black men that have gathered around her to offer her some assistance, she starts going back and forth. And to me, when I look at the situation, I see, this is just my opinion, I see Mr. Lean kind of reactionary, having been surrounded by, I mean, what is obviously almost, it seems like an acre of bikers, and he reacts for what he believes, you know, to be instinctively. Like, I don't know these people. I could be in trouble. I've just tapped somebody's bike, and I'm at the scene of an accident. I'm going to do what I feel like I have to do.
So what's your point here? Is it, you're saying that you think that he was reacting to the bikers or to the race of the bikers? That's what I'm wondering.
I think this is one of those cases I'm fond of saying that, you know, that race complicates matters. You know, I don't think that race is, I don't think this is a strictly black and white conversation, but I do believe that the race of being surrounded by 300 odd black bikers, anybody would probably be fearful. So I think race definitely complicates the matter.
Papa, what about you? Yeah, here in New York.
Yeah, I will be driving that stretch of road tomorrow, and I do quite frequently. I would say first off that the fact that there is a roving gang of bikers, period, and I mean an acre, is about right. I mean, if you watch the video, and the fact that there's a video of this is just such a insanely perfect emblem of where we are in our society, that there's a helmet cam of all this happening. The fact that there's a roving gang of bikers is troubling to begin with.
But why are they a gang? What makes them a gang?
No, it's literally a collection of people riding together with
stunts,
a purpose, and with under a cabin, you know.
If they were biking, if they were using regular two-wheeled bikes, I don't know what you call a bike that's not a motorbike.
Bicycle.
Would they be a gang? I mean, I see groups of guys riding their bicycles in the park
Saturday. I don't even mean that in a racial way. I think I mean it in a motorcycle gang is just a term that's applied to the Hell's Angels, who are obviously very white in a lot of respects. And certainly in this case, I think, with a group that's certainly colored, or at least is various shades of brown and black. We don't exactly know who everybody is with the helmets on. But all of that said, the fact that there is this collection, this acre of motorcycles surrounding cars, is ridiculous to begin with. And the fact that something horrible And I obviously feel tremendously horrible for the guy who was paralyzed. But the fact that they were all in that situation and something like this happened cannot be surprising. Where I would put the most blame, though, honestly, is where, I mean, and we're talking about police, where in Mike Bloomberg's New York is the police department? Because this video went on for a really, really long time, and I did not see a single siren or flashing light.
Hmm.
Mario.
Well, I just want to give a shout out to all of those people in law school who are going to see this on their final exam, because this is like a
totally
perfect law school exam question.
Of what?
And the question
that's
is
a good question. Yeah, what is the question?
Well, I mean, the question would be torts, and it would be all about contributory negligence and foreseeable consequences and proximate cause. I mean, the basic question is, you have the initial negligence of the initial motorcyclist who slowed down and then foreseeably, you know, getting the Land Rover to bump into him. Everything that happened after that, was it foreseeable, or who contributed negligence, who was criminally negligent? And I mean, you could spend an entire hour in a law school exam going through the analysis of this chain of events. But I think, you know, if you're in a gang of bikes and you start harassing and intimidating someone in a car, someone's going to get hurt.
But why is it? What I'm asking is, it inherently intimidating that they were on bikes and that there were many of them? You see what I'm saying? Would a bicycle there were a group of guys on bicycles, 300 bicycles, is it the motorcycle that makes them inherently intimidating? Why? Why are they
I think it's all
well, Michelle,
above,
they were doing motorcycle tricks that were intended to intimidate drivers and put them in close proximity to cars, e.g. the trick that he was trying where he was bumping the front bumper of car. You know, I mean, you're not going to do that on a Huffy. You know, you're not going to do that on a swing. You know,
I'm asking, were they intended to intimidate drivers, or were they intended to show off? Is there a difference?
I think it's both. I can't derive any other logical reason why you would be riding around like that.
When you're driving a vehicle, especially if you're on a freeway or a highway, when bikes, groups of bikers come of any shade, of any type of bike, it doesn't matter. When they come close to your vehicle, when they're zooming past you, like they were in this case, the automatic reaction for a vehicle driver, for a car driver, is to get nervous, period. And they were weaving in and out of traffic. They did cut the driver off, the Range Rover off, and then back up and slow down. And they created a circumstance where this driver is going to get nervous. And once a driver is nervous, especially driving a big car like a Range Rover,
with your family,
all kinds of bad judgment can happen.
With your daughter and your wife.
This is before the circumstances went awry. The circumstances and first of all, I don't know about a gang or anything. This could be just an affinity group. You have affinity groups that, you know, all own Cadillacs. You have affinity groups that all own, you know, IROC Zs. I mean, that's not unusual. But anytime you have motorcyclists in this group in tight quarters on a highway at high speeds, they do intimidate vehicle drivers, period.
Well, I want to hear the guys' perspectives. That's why we're talking about it. I appreciate it. We're having our weekly barbershop roundtable with writer Jimmy Israel, lawyer and commentator Mario Loyola, journalist Corey Date, sports writer Pablo Torre. Can we just do a quick check-in on the government shutdown? I just feel that it's important to ask all of you about it. And I just want to
know, since we've been fighting off. Is that still happening?
Yes, it is. Hero. Who's the hero and who's the zero in this, Corey?
Well, you know, I will say I have a tie. Well, zero, let me back up. The zero is John Boehner. You know, he just punked out. He can't get his caucus to do what is necessary. He doesn't want to shut down, but he couldn't get his caucus behind it. So, you know, everyone talks about lame duck presidency. At this point, he's kind of a lame duck speaker. All right. Now, on the hero side, I will say that there's Obama, but really my big hero is Rand Paul.
Really?
Rand Paul. You know why? Because he hates Obamacare just as much as Ted Cruz, but he is staying clear of this effort to tack Obamacare to the shutdown. He's called for a clean resolution because he wants to run for president in 2016. He's being very smart.
And he'd like there to be a government to run for, right?
That's right.
Okay, Super Mario, what about you? Who's the hero? Who's the zero in this?
Well, my hero is the backroom deal that is going to get us out of this situation, and I hope that Americans are acquiring a new appreciation for backroom deals because they're much better than this schoolyard spat where nobody's backing down. But I mean, look, what is the president's position? That he's not going to negotiate with the Republican House until they turn into Democrats? I mean, I don't think that's reasonable either. And, you know, it's one half of the government. I mean, it's one half of Congress. Elections have consequences. I think Obama's got to negotiate with the Republicans here.
Pablo, what about you?
I'm inclined to say that, I mean, the losers are, I mean, it's everybody who elected this Congress. And I think the idea, I think the gut check moment has arrived many times before, but now it's kind of like, if you're not going to get outraged about this happening, and if you're not going to do anything or talk to your representative or vote a certain way the next time, then what are you waiting for? And if we don't do it again, if this happens again, and we do the same thing, who else do we have to blame but the people who elected these people?
Hmm. Jimmy, what about you?
Michelle, there are no heroes, too many zeros to count. You know, I said a few weeks ago that if we had a shutdown, this would be a failure of government, also a failure of leadership. You know, we all lose in this, you know, and no, this is like an American embarrassment. I'd put a bag over my head and be like, you know, for shame. But
you got
I do love
the Browns fan on America, Jimmy. Is that what you're saying?
Maybe, although I'm not fair weather like Cleveland Browns fan. Sorry, Cleveland, but yeah, like that.
Well, before we let you go, I just wanted to take a minute, if I may, gentlemen, to recognize a woman who is, I know this is a barbershop, but I did want to take a moment to recognize a woman who is very influential for journalists of color and many women in the field. Lee Thornton was the first black host of All Things Considered on this network. She was the first black woman to cover the White House for a major news network. She worked for CBS beginning in 1977, and she died last week at the age of 71. And as you know, I may have mentioned, I also served as a White House correspondent. On it, and she definitely made a mark on my life. She was certainly a role model for many of us, not just women, not just people of color, but just as an elegant, forceful, caring person, and went on to have an important career as a professor of journalism. And I just wanted to just take a moment to thank her and to remember her and to say that our thoughts are with her family. So that's all we have time for today. Corey Dade is a contributing editor for The Root with us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Jimmy Israel is a writer, adjunct professor of film and social media at Cuyahoga Community College with us from WCPN in Cleveland. Pablo Torre is a senior writer for ESPN with us from our bureau in New York. And Mario Loyola is chief counsel at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, also a columnist for National Review with us from Austin. Gentlemen, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Watch out.
Yep.
And remember, if you can't get enough Barbershop Buzz on the radio, look for our Barbershop podcast. That's in the iTunes store or NPR.org. That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin. This is Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tune in for more talk on Monday.